You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hello again, and welcome back to Fly on the Call, candid conversations on music. I'm super excited about today's guest because it was my third time interviewing Barty Strange, and it's been amazing to see how far he's come in the last few years. Barty's recently released his first EP under the name Barty Strange, Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy. This release serves as a tribute to his favorite band, The National, and finds him doing fully fleshed out alternative versions of their songs, rather than simply covering him. You'll hear us talk all about the process and inspiration behind the EP, redefining and reinventing yourself, and so much more. Enjoy. With the Hayley Williams and Ryan Reynolds shout out, who's going to be the celebrity that completes the trifecta for you?
Oh my God. Yo, that's crazy. I was like, yo. It was really cool. I was really surprised by that. I thought that was really cool that he liked it. Yeah,
for sure. And it's so random too. Like, it really surprised me, the Ryan Reynolds thing, because like Hayley, like you basically asked her to like listen to it, and then. Which it was crazy how instantaneous that happened too.
Yeah, I was shocked by that.
Mm-hmm. Like your bio talks about how you're like born in England and grew up like kind of throughout Europe and the United States, but I haven't really like seen you talk much about that. So I'm curious, like what kind of like was your pre-Oklahoma life like?
Yeah, I mean, I moved a lot. My mom is a singer, and she was singing there, and my dad is a military, so he was in the Air Force and he was based. RAF Bentwaters. I'm saying the base because I feel like every once in a while a random person is like, holy shit, my dad was also stationed in Italy. And I'm like, yeah, like fine, someone knows. Yeah, so that's where he was stationed. I was in between there and Lincoln Heath, and then we moved to Bitburg, Germany, where my little brother was born, and then we moved back to the UK and stayed for a while, and then Greenland, and a couple other random stops in Europe quickly, and then we went to Alamogordo, New Mexico, Atwater, California, and then Moore, Oklahoma, and then Mustang, Oklahoma. Yeah, and we stayed there. My dad got stationed there. My mom taught at the University of Oklahoma. But yeah, I mean, I was like a kid in Europe, so, you know, I grew up and, you know, with my mom a lot. She was a singer and traveled a little bit over there singing. She's an opera singer, so... you know, sitting in a lot of opera houses and churches, and, you know, my dad was, you know, traveling in the military a lot. I think it was like Desert Storm time when I was, you know, in the late 80s when I was born. And so, you know, like, I don't know all the timeline stuff, but, you know, my dad was in the military and had to travel a lot, Kuwait and random, but a lot of people that I like grew up with, I still like am in touch with. And, you know, it was kind of a cool way to find music. Like, you know, I felt like I always had like a weird influx. Like I'd get like periodic like dumps of music because we'd be moving. You know, my mom's like was super religious, and like we were mostly in church, and she wasn't really into secular music, you know? So I got all of that stuff like through people in school, and it was, you know, pretty random schools you could imagine, like in military type environments, and everyone's kind of from everywhere. So you get pieces of everything. And then, you know, when I moved to Oklahoma, I just kind of had like a really weird frame of reference, I guess, you know, of like what was normal and what wasn't, and what was cool to listen to and what wasn't. And so then I met like country music and, you know, stuff like that. So sorry, I've just been like talking for a while, but
no, I mean, it's super interesting. Like I know you mentioned it was like kind of like a plethora of stuff, but like what kind of was it that hit you the most, like in those pre like country and like finding like the hardcore scene in Oklahoma days?
I mean, honestly, I was a kid, so, you know, I'm like 8, 9, 10, you know, like, and honestly, like, this is what Kirk Franklin like church music, you know, like I grew up listening to like gospel music all the time, you know, gospel music and like soul music and things that my parents listened to. That was probably my main influences for, you know, my young life. And like my dad is like a big audiophile music nerd. Like he definitely would, if this is like a deep cut joke that only like random people will get, but like, if you ask my dad where he's from, he says, "Oh, I'm from Trafalmador," which is like where George Clinton says he's from in Parliament, you know, probably a funkadelic song. So my dad's like really into funk, really into like the beginnings of pop music, and he collects a lot of records. And when he was in the military in Japan, he collected a lot of like hi-fi, like recording and like listening, like, you know, like audio equipment. Like headphones and speakers and all this kind of stuff. So he was always playing interesting things. And so I would say like between like a lot of gospel music and then like all of the funk that my dad was playing and Erykah Badu, my dad's a huge Erykah Badu fan. So Sade, like all that like smooth jazz 90s wave stuff. You know, that was kind of it. And then I had friends that I was meeting who were into like Scream and Burial and, Kraftwerk and like, you know, so it was like, a lot of like housey stuff, like beat driven stuff. And then like a whole other side of like rhythmic music. Right. I mean, with like the gospel stuff and, you know, funk that my dad was bringing in. So that was kind of like, before I was like, oh, I want to scream in a hardcore band. Definitely like, yo, I want to like be a singer in a church, like Kirk Franklin.
Yeah, and you mentioned like your dad being into like the hi-fi equipment and stuff. When was it that like I feel like I've heard you say more often than you're a musician say that you're a producer. Like when was it that kind of like engineering type stuff came in, and like was your dad being into like that equipment part of what influenced you towards that?
I think so. Like I think like if you ever meet my dad or if anyone meets my dad, he's like definitely a tinkerer, right? So like he's not like he's never like recorded bands or anything like that. But he loves getting like old Denon like record players and fixing them. Like that's kind of something my dad would do, right? And he's like really into cars. And I think that like in taking them apart and putting them back together. And I think that's kind of how I got into gear. And like, you know, when I started like playing guitars, it's like how guitars worked. And like, I was like, what else can I put a pickup on? Like what else, you know, how can I create more sounds? And I think I've always just kind of been into sound from like a, how do you make it, like actually physically, like how does it work kind of. And and so that's kind of, I think my dad definitely had that like kind of influence on me. But I started getting into that probably like I feel like later than a lot of people, because like I, you know, I was always playing music and singing it, but I never was writing songs for anyone or anything. But you know, in like high school I started like, you know, recording my friends' bands, and we did like a little recording of our band, and I was really into like microphones, and I tried to get a little collection of them. I had a bunch of really horrible microphones, and you know, we did a lot of stuff on like little Porta Studios, like little tape decks, and it was cool. You know, that was kind of like my first experience doing it. And then as I got into like college, I got like FL Studio, and I was like, oh, I made a lot of beats. Like my friend Marvel Alexander, he goes by Boss Man now. He's a guy that lives in LA and produces like incredible music. But like, you know, he was like one of my like first like production friend people who was like, I feel like the best way to get good at guitar is to have a friend who's really good at guitar and you're going to get good. And I feel the same with like producing and engineering. Like if you have friends around you who are good at it, then you get good really fast.
Yeah, that makes sense. And has it made it like easier or harder for you to kind of like let the reins go when you're in the studio, or like when it comes to like the mixing and mastering and stuff?
Oh yeah, I'm not precious with it, to be honest. Like I love collaborating. I rarely write by myself. So, you know, when people are, you know, when it comes time for me to hand a mix over, I'm like, please get it out of here. Like get this thing out of my face, because I hate the song already. I can't tell if it's good. Like, you know, someone please validate this music.
Yeah, and like one of the originals on Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy is Going, which was, you know, originally released on like the Bartiz and the Strange Fruit EP. What was it that kind of like made you revisit that song, especially considering you said like you kind of like get to the point where you're like fed up with songs?
Yo, so like that song is just, I love that song. And even the recording that's up now, I'm like, God, I want to re-record it. Like, there are like things in the song that I'm like, it's great. It's totally fine. And I can't wait to hit to do it again. Like, I think 3 years ago, I played a show at St. Vitus in New York with an all black orchestra of kids aged from like, I think, like eighth grade to like high school. I wish I could remember the nonprofit, but Zach Fisher from Good Looking Friends like helped set it up, and Shelly, the saxophone player in his band, they arranged like a orchestral arrangement around that song, and we recorded it, or not recorded it, but we played it live. Mm-hmm. And when we played it live, I was like, oh my God, I have to re-record this song. Like, because I was like, this sounds so much cooler than just the acoustic version. And, you know, and then after like Kanye West, like did like The Life of Pablo, and I was like, oh, okay, cool. Like, it's cool to have like multiple versions of a song exist. Like, sure. Why not? Like, I'll just like redo it in a couple years. And this was that. Yeah. So, you know, so I was happy to be able to redo it again. And I really want to record like an orchestral arrangement of it pretty bad. So please, please fates, let it happen.
Yeah. That'd be, I'm sure that'd be awesome. I've been like getting really into like Fish and the Grateful Dead lately for some reason. Oh, wow. And like there was like a run of shows in the 90s where Fish did like a bunch of shows with like a horn section. It's like, it's so interesting to see like just how different the songs can be.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And that's like the fun part, right? Like, I feel like there's a lot of pressure on artists to release a lot of music these days. And I think a lot of people think that the way to do that is to release a lot of new things. And like, you know, we put out a record, let's put out another record next year. But I'm kind of into the idea of like, put out like an acoustic version of the record, put out a record of it with strings, like put out a record of it with someone else singing everything. Like this like little EP with The National like really opened my eyes to like how many forms a song can take and how many stories like a singular song can take. Like just depending on who's delivering the message. Like it's really interesting. I would love to see that, you know, investigated more. Yeah, it's cool.
For sure. Yeah. And I'm curious, like, did the idea for the EP start to come together like before you were talking to Brassland, or was that kind of like as the discussions were happening?
Yeah, it was before I met Brassland. You know, like the idea of it all happened organically. Like me and my buddy Carter used to always kind of joke around. Also, Carter plays drums in the band. but you know, we've used to always joke around about like, oh, like we should cover some National songs. And I was like, no, like it's impossible. The songs are all good. They can't be touched by anyone. And he was like, think about it. We should do it. And it's, you know, just like over the course of our friendship, I've known him for 5 years, like he's always kind of brought it up. And then like my partner, Kaylee, like she was like, yo, like you should think about doing some more covers. And I was like, I don't know. I don't really like doing covers. And then I went to a show, a National show here in DC, and you know, they were playing with Courtney Barnett, and I was like, oh, this is amazing. Like I got to see this show. I went, it was an amazing show. They both killed it. The National is like always at their best. And I just remember looking out in the room and being like, damn, I haven't in a long time. Like when like there's like 600 people in a room and all of them are white. And I was like, this is DC, like, you know, one of the blackest cities still, you know, even though it's gentrifying, one of the most black cities in the country. And I was just like, it's so wild that in like Southeast DC right now, like there's a room of white people bumping the National. There's no black people here. I was just like, how does that happen? You know, and just, you know, no knock on the National or Courtney Barnett or anyone, like, you know, this is not even about them at this point, you know. Now my mind went on to kind of thinking about like, how does like this happen like within the industry? Like, why aren't there more bands that are making music like the National but that are, you know, not all white? Like, how does it after all, like all of the contributions that, you know, non-white people have made to the genre, indie music or whatever, you would expect to see more of them at that level, you know. And that's kind of like where the idea of the project came. And I was like, I would like to kind of hit these songs, but bring like my background to them to like, you know, maybe shine a new light on the songs. And also kind of as like a home, like a homage to like how much I love the Nationals, my favorite band. So that's kind of like how the idea came together. And I pitched it to my friend Blake, who is on Brassland Records. His band is called Fusilier. And he said, oh, you should meet Alec and, you know, run this idea by him and see what he thinks. And, you know, if he hates it, you can always just do it anyways. And I was like, oh, I guess you're right. Like, you can just cover anything. And but I didn't feel comfortable doing it. I wanted to do it with, I wanted the coastline of the National, you know. I was like, you know, I want them to see it. And, you know, I met up with Alec. We just talked about it. And he's asked me, he was like, you know, send me a song or two. And I sent him a few and he liked them. And it just kind of moved organically from there. The band liked it. You know, it just worked out. Yeah. It just worked out. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that is really awesome, especially because of like how much of yourself you put into the covers, like to the point where they're almost not even covers anymore. So it's like especially cool to know that like you kind of like have their blessing for it.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for it, and shout out to them. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and I read that like part of the process for you know, like re-envisioning these songs was kind of like finding, you know, the one or two elements that you like really love about the song, kind of like expanding them into the whole thing. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and kind of like, you know, which ones were kind of like easier for you and which ones were more challenging?
Yeah, sure. So, okay. Yes. I'll start with About Today. That's the first song on the EP, and probably my favorite. And I think it's also the one you can most clearly see the link. So on the first version, the original, which is on Cherry Tree, which was like a short EP, they the song has a rhythm that is just, I mean, it's like a lot of Devendorf's drumming. It doesn't really change throughout the entire song. And I've always kind of likened his drumming to like a drum machine. Like it's just like super in pocket, super tight rhythms, no fat, no fills. If there's a change, it's like switching from like the hi-hat to the ride. Like that's the change. But when the change comes, like the whole song shifts and you feel it, right? It's like very deliberate drumming. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mimic that in the song by like just making it a drum machine. You know, being like, let's have a drum machine. And you know, we triggered it to do something that was like very like housey and like on the backbeat, which I feel like is kind of symptomatic of a lot of his playing, where it's like he's got like really driving, you know, drum parts that almost remind me of like, you know, it's you know, really powerful deliberate drums. And so I wanted to kind of mimic that in the song, and I think that I feel like that's the one we accomplished it like the most cleanly, like tying the link to like a particular element of the songs. But yeah, that's one. And then there were other ones that were like way more challenging and we just went in completely different directions with. Like, I don't know, All the Wine. Lemon World, for example. Like, Lemon World, we just, instead of tying it to the sonic elements of the original song, I started thinking like more thematically. And I thought, okay, like, how can we like, just like, make this song completely opposite and like still maintain like the continuity, I guess. And so like Graham, who plays keys in the band and everything else, like Graham plays keys and plays bass, and like he's a synth player and he's a freakish guitar player, really cool guy too. Beginning of the song, one's playing in 15, one's playing in 16, and the rhythm section is also alternating between 16 and 15 opposite, so it's all inverted. And they stay like that and they meet up really randomly throughout the song. And that is like, it's like stupid and like way too complex to ever be noticed. But it's like, we wrote that part because in a band called Clogs, which I think like Aaron and Bryce Desner were in, they write in all these wild time signatures where like the guitars are in 7 and the drums are in 4 and da 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 da, and like it all meets. And we kind of wanted to signal like to National Deep Cut fans, like, yo, like we know the shit. We know. And like, even though the song sounds nothing like the original, I hope that you realize that this is that shit. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, it's, yeah, so like we try to do stuff like that too, like little Easter eggs, I guess. But I don't know. We're probably the only people who will ever catch them.
I think it's really cool though too. Like, you know, how he said, you know, how they like meet at specific times or like, I think, you know, that's something you can sense as a listener, even if you don't know exactly what's going on. It's like you feel that kind of like, and it like makes for a little special moment with him.
Great. I hope so. Great.
Yeah. And I mean, other than being, you know, sonically different, a lot of the lyrics kind of feel like they take on a new meaning with you kind of like singing them, especially on tracks like Mr. November or Lemon World. Was that something you kind of like anticipated or had in mind going into it? Or did it kind of like just happen during the process?
It totally happened during the process. Like Lemon World, when that song, I had no idea how we were going to make that song work. And like, I mean, it just like totally morphed in meaning to me. Like, for example, the original song, I've always taken it to mean Matt is dealing with feelings about feeling like he's broke as fuck living in Brooklyn. Like all these other people around him are doing well. And he's like working, you know, he's like struggling and to get by. But when I read the lyrics and like started singing it, I was like, yo, I remember struggling in Brooklyn, but like, it feels different. Like I'm like looking at all of my friends, you know, like I'm not a rich kid in Brooklyn. I wasn't, you know, like, and most of the people I knew in Brooklyn, like came from like some, there was some money somewhere. So they were living like way more comfortable than me. And like definitely traveling, getting married, buying houses, like dogs. I'm like, how are you buying a house in Crown Heights? Like who can? Like, how does this happen? You're 28 years old. You know, I was like, how do you do this? And I'm like, damn, like you and your sister live in a lemon world and I want to stay in and die. You know, like I'm sick of going outside and seeing all of this around me. It just reminds me that I'm never going to have this, you know, like that shit was eating at me for years when I was living in Brooklyn. It sent me now here in DC, you know, and that song, as I sang it and worked it, I was like, yo, like, I feel this. Yeah. Like I remember this feeling, you know, and I hope we were able to like bring that like energy to the song in a new way, you know? You know, and that was kind of a big thing. And same with like Mr. November, you know, and All the Wine, there's a line in All the Wine, which like, you know, when I hear Matt sing it now, I'm like, oh my gosh, how did this like get out? But there's a part where he's like, I'm a birthday candle in a circle of black girls. God is on my side. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, regardless of the intention of the lyric, just a weird lyric. Yeah. Right. Like, it's like, whoa. Like, this is a white guy. So what is he? What is that? You know, like there's so many ways that could be taken wrong. Might not have been meant the best way, you know, like who knows the intent of that lyric or what it meant. But you know, to like re-sing that and it almost feel like a safe thing to say. I was like, this is interesting. Like, you know, that these lines can be construed so differently just based on who's saying it, you know. It's a interesting little thing to think about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or like on Mr. November, I think it is, but he like references like the Great White Hope. That was one that like stood out to me too, because there's been like a couple other songs that have like referenced it before. So I've kind of like, you know, found out, you know, like the meaning behind it. How was like, and that song specifically, like you kind of like turning it almost into like more anthemic than it was originally. Like, can you tell me about that a little bit?
Yeah. That song, Mr. November, is one of my favorites ever from the National. And like, I chose it, like the idea of Mr. November, like it kind of like always stood out to me because I was like, you know, I don't know if this is like completely accurate, but I feel like Mr. November, it's like the calendar model. Like, you know, this is Mr. November, the most beautiful man in the United, it's the Western world, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like to think that like that could be someone like me or someone that just isn't like a really like good average looking white guy or whatever. Like it's like a really cool idea to like be like, yo, I'm the new blue blood, I'm the great white hope, you know, like it's me, you know. It's cool to imagine that world. And you know, music, you can make it any world you want, right? So like that's like kind of why I wanted to choose that. And yeah, totally. I hope that when people hear that and realize that I'm singing it, that they like kind of get that, you know, I hope they see that. Mm-hmm.
For sure. Yeah. And I mean, Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy as a whole is kind of like a reintroduction to you as a solo artist after, you know, Bartiz and the Strange Fruit. And then like last year Within the Cab. So like, it feels like you kind of like are constantly in this process of like reinventing yourself. Is that, can you just like tell me about that? Is that something that you are doing intentionally?
Yeah. And I don't, yeah, it's interesting. This is a great question. So I guess I don't think of it as reinventing myself. I think of it as like refining, mm-hmm. like getting more closer to what I want and like being able to see more clearly what I want to say. Right. It's like, I think of kind of like, I always want to, I feel like in music and in the way that I'm creating stuff, I'm always trying to find ways to like be more clear, right? Mm-hmm. And that's also like a thing that I love about The National is like how deliberate you can tell they are with their art. You can see planned out and you understand the intentionality behind it. And I, mm-hmm. and I strive for that, like with what I make and with who I'm trying to tell people I am. Right. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, you know, kind of changing my name and honestly, like making it shorter is like, it's like a part of like refining it. And, mm-hmm. you know, like the music I'm making, you know, I started, you know, the last project was like heavy folk influence, you know, and that was a really cool project, but I didn't think that it was like the best reflection of everything that I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, cool. Like let's use In a Cab to kind of like shift this like whole body of work that I want to do and just like kind of better position it, mm-hmm. You know, for like everyone to hear. So, you know, it was like, yeah, I just kind of wanted to refine it a little bit, I guess. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, going off that, I mean, I know last year, I think it was in the Billboard piece for In a Cab, actually, I revisited it today, and you mentioned like 30 songs written, you recorded like more than 20 of them, and then you had, I think actually in the Billboard interview, you like mentioned that you had just received the mixes for, you know, the 14 of them that were going to be on the album, which obviously mm-hmm. hasn't come out yet and is due out at some point, hopefully later this year. But I'm curious, like, has it sounded like that at that time was kind of like almost set in stone, but has it been changed since then? Has it kind of stayed the same or been like broken down or been reimagined?
Well, been refined. I was like, do all these songs need to be on there? Who knows? Let's take one or two off. And I literally, God damn, I literally, you know, I've been writing since, you know, I recorded that record and I've like, I'm ready to, you know, start recording some more, and I've recorded a few and I'm like, hey, let's throw these on the record, but everyone is saying don't do it, like just let it ride. And I think they're right. Like I want that record to be a snapshot of like who I was at that time, and it's gonna be totally it's fine. Like damn, people's records sit for so long before they go out sometimes. It's just kind of a part of it. So mm-hmm. I'm learning that now. I didn't understand that last year.
I mean, I saw like in a couple different interviews that kind of what really made The National kind of like click for you was seeing them live and how different they sounded on the record and almost had like the, you know, energy and feel of like a hardcore band. Like, can you tell me a little bit more about that first experience seeing them live?
Yeah, sure. I went with my friend Grant, who was a big National fan that I grew up near in Oklahoma, a good buddy of mine. He had introduced me to the band. And, you know, we went to see them. I think they were playing in like Tulsa or Denton, Texas. It's either Tulsa or Denton, Texas. I can't remember. But I think it's Tulsa. We went to see them. And like, I remember being like, damn, like they don't sound anything like the record. This is cool. Like, because at the time, like I was like playing in hardcore bands and all I listened to was like hardcore shit and like Bon Iver. Like that was like my freshman year of college in a weird, you know, weird freshman sophomore year of college. And yeah, like they just totally crushed, and there wasn't even that many people there. Like it was an empty room, it was like half full, and like I remember people being like totally like, some people didn't love that they didn't sound like the record. I, on the other hand, was like, you can do this. Like, you can make a record and then, like, just perform it however you want. Like, have fun with it. I don't think that idea had ever clicked in my brain before. Mm-hmm. The way that you can, like, you know, like kind of like what we were talking about earlier, like diving deeper into your songs. You know, like you write a song, you present it one way, present it another way. Who cares? Like, you wrote the song, do whatever you want. And like that idea of like doing whatever you want, I just hadn't really thought you could do that, like with music. And that was like a definitely like a shift in my like life, like, not just in like music. I was like, oh shit, I want to do whatever I want. Like with music, like just like I want to be able to present it how I want. I want to tell the story how I want. Boom, boom. And there were some other artists that, you know, bolstered and like pushed that idea forward. But seeing them live was like a critical moment for sure for me. For sure. And you know, I just never seen a band that, you know, like I said, deliberate, clear. Like they just were so, they were perfect. And I've never seen anything like that before. Yeah.
And I mean, when I saw you last year, there was kind of like more of a raw punk energy to like the live show than the record stuff that you released at the time. Is that kind of something you're trying to channel as well with it, or is the like, how's the new album going to compare to, you know, the live show?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I like doing things just different, you know, all sorts of ways. And I think that was like the cool thing about the national record is like we got to really investigate this like, or build out some sounds that I've just always wanted to play with and like make songs around. So it was like a cool experimental moment, like period. And with this next record, like, you know, I don't know, like I'm energetic. You know, I like to have a good time on stage. I don't know. Like, I guess people would say that like I'm kind of punk-y, but I came up playing in hardcore bands and, you know, church and singing in church. So it's like that is the combo. I guess no matter what I do, I feel like I'm always like intense, but yeah. And I'm, you know, I like to have a good time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. I mean, that combo is definitely very like uniquely you in some ways.
Hardcore church. No, that's hilarious. Yeah. I guess that's true.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then I also like, I mean, we've been talking about like kind of the process of you like refining yourself and stuff. And I feel like the title of the EP, like Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy, kind of plays into that interestingly. And also the fact that it's, you know, it's a national lyric, but not from one of the songs that you covered. Like what made you choose that title? What does it like kind of mean to you?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what it meant to me. So, you know, my last project was called, Magic Boy, first, you know, Bartiz and the Strange Fruit record. And you know, I kind of wanted to reference that a little bit for people who knew me, to kind of signify like a shift away from that, you know, from that stuff to this new work that I'll be putting out. Mm-hmm. And also like, you know, I thought that it kind of also, to your point, and thanks for noticing, kind of also falls into what I'm trying to do with like, you know, further refining the type of music I want to make. And I wanted to like, you know, there were other songs I wanted to cover. And that we did cover that we didn't really get to, that we're not going to put out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I took Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy because I wanted to cover that song.
And so in the process of when you were like initially trying to start to cover that song, was that one of the ones that also like, did that lyric change for you, the meaning?
Yeah, I mean, I just thought that line always was, it was always important to me. Like the song, first of all, it's from the song Murder Me, Rachel, which is like a dope song by The National, one of my favorites. And they've performed it multiple different ways, recorded it multiple different ways. I think it's on three of their records and it's, it changes on each one. And that's always like been kind of cool to me, like kind of to this point of refinement and being deliberate and like also not being afraid to just do whatever you want and, you know, put it out three different times, like reintroduce the song, do whatever you want with it, you know? And I've always loved that. And I really do believe that like my pathway to kind of like this record and my next record and whatever else I do, there's been a lot of refinement and trying things again and again and putting myself out there in different ways and getting closer to like who I actually am. And I feel like that's like a life journey thing I've been on for so long. Like one thing that's always been kind of like a drag about like moving a lot or being like the only Black person in a place forever or anything like that. Things that make you feel alone and kind of like no one gets you. You learn to shapeshift and kind of just fit wherever you move. And I think that's like a cool talent that or thing you can pick up, but it's also makes you really lonely. And I felt like as many people I was able to meet and friends I was able to gain, no one ever really knew me because I was always changing to fit thought I should be or what I thought I needed to be to fit in. And so like this record and the music I've been a part of me stepping into myself and realizing like, oh, like this is who I am and this is it, and I should be, you know, be able to kind of go after these things and not feel limited by a genre or limited by, you know, what people think I should be. Like if I can make beats and play country music and sing and scream and play hardcore stuff, like let's just do all of it. And that's kind of like why I decided to kind of say goodbye to trying to be the pretty boy, like trying to fit in, you know, trying to, you know, be what people think I should be. And you know, and I think that's kind of also why that title was chosen. So yeah, that's my full answer.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's awesome and makes a lot of sense for sure. And I also like, I'm a big cover art person partially because I'm super into vinyl and stuff, and I'm definitely gonna be picking up the EP on that. But I feel like the artwork for the EP is like, so it's like really, I love the way that's kind of like minimalistic, but also, you know, like for me, like the press release and stuff, like the symbolism behind it, with like the ripped up sticker and the Pan-African flag. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Like what your kind of thoughts were going into it and how it was created?
Yeah, sure. The person that did it is my friend Gabby. She's really talented. I was really happy to work with her on it. But she, you know, we shot like a few ideas back and forth. And, you know, I was having I'm really bad at like visual, and like anything, just never, I am not good at expressing complex things in a visual way, just not. And I was talking through like some of the ideas of the record and we drew up a few mock-ups. And then I was in Atlanta recently, or like recently as like a year ago, and I met this guy named Kevin Roger Sipp, who works at a number of museums across Atlanta, but he's a Black guy. And he started talking about like the early 90s in Atlanta and the late 80s and how he was playing in hardcore bands. And I was like, whoa, tell me about this. Then he was like, well, you know, it all started with Black Dot, Bad Brains. You're from DC, you know them. And I was like, yeah, I know Bad Brains, but I don't know this record, the Black Dot. And he was like, yo, so the record came out and like, it was like not like sold well. And then it was re-released and blah, blah. It's like, just like kind of like a lost record, but became really influential in the hardcore scene in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. He like sent it to me. He was like, yo, listen to it. Like you should listen to this record. And I was like, oh shit, I gotta like reference this. And that record cover is just a big Black Dot. Right. And so mm-hmm. I was like, perfect. This like totally illustrates this idea of like, you know, Black people in a way. And then like it's frayed because it looks like they're trying to be torn off of this like white background or like the larger scene. And I was like, okay, this is like a good way to illustrate that idea, especially because of how influential they've been like in my life and in the larger musical space. And that's kind of like what we're trying to say with the record. And then like the Pan-African flag, how like what is a national like in America, like, you know, I'm a Black national, you know, like what does it mean to, you know, kind of like pick apart that idea a little bit. And you know, so I just wanted to reference that. And you know, it's so funny, like I felt like so many weird feelings about thing, and like people kept saying this to me, like, no names will be named, but they're like, how do we make sure people know that you're Black? Like, how do we do it if they don't see your face on the cover of the record? And I was like, I put the Pan African flag on the record. hopefully they see it and they say a black person did this. If not, we have deeper issues. I don't know. We've lost that person. But anyways, yeah, you know, we really tried to make the ideas like, you know, consistent throughout, and Gabby like totally nailed it. Like, shout out to her in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I always kind of like to end the episodes by asking for either just like, you know, something, either like a piece of advice or, you know, something you've been like kind of contemplating lately that you would just kind of like to share with the audience, whether it's about like music specifically or, you know, life as a whole.
About music or about life. That's tough. Well, first off, like, I want to say, like, thanks for having me.
Of course.
Like, it's been cool to talk to you. And the artist that did the cover, her name is Gabby Hastings. I just didn't want to leave her last name out. And I guess, I don't know, like, something to leave people with. I don't know. Like, I've done like a lot of shit in my life. Like, I've been lucky to try a lot of things. Like I grew up in a lot of places, and I've got to meet a lot of people and have friendships and relationships with people that I never thought I would meet because of music, and like because of like the little communities that it's created. And I'm really thankful for like the people who helped me make this record and my next record, and the, you know, the people I've met. And I think it's important for anyone that's creating things to remember that, like, even if you have good ideas, or even if you think you've got like hot stuff, like the importance of having like people around you who are talented and who believe in you, right? And that's something that I don't think I ever really understood the power of until really like the last year, like having people that are like, oh, we're gonna like invest time in like helping you be great at this, and like, how important it is to invest in those relationships. And you know, they really do make all the difference, you know, when it really comes, when it really counts. So like, you know, never underestimate the importance of building community, like as you build your music, because that's really what's going to help you. And, you know, I say that as someone who is like not popular or famous or anything, but like, I see like how the people I've been there for in the past are like stepping up for me and, you know, helping more people hear my stuff. And that really is like how everything works. So yeah, pull, you know, lift people up, lift up the people around you, because, you know, you never know who's going to do stuff. And if one person makes it, everybody makes it, right? So got to be there for each other.
And now you know Barty Strange. If you weren't already familiar with him and or The National, Say Goodbye to Pretty Boy is a great chance to hop on. I personally had never listened to The National before, and this was a very cool introduction to some of their music. If you like what you hear, keep giving it your streams. Buy it on Bandcamp or pre-order the vinyl. Bartiz is in the same boat as so many other musicians who have had their years turned upside down due to COVID and tour cancellations, so anything you can do to help will be greatly appreciated. A special thank you, as always, to The Alternative for helping to promote the show, to Kaylin West of Tiny Stills for the theme song, and Michaela Jane Palermo for the artwork. You can keep up to date by subscribing to the podcast and following the show on Twitter and Instagram at FlyInTheCallPod. Feel free to email any questions, comments, or other feedback to me at FlyInTheCallPod@gmail.com. And stay happy and healthy, y'all.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.